secret for decades, are really part of the problem here. And we have to ask ourselves why we're willing to subordinate the truth to having access to power.
And you mentioned Justice Brett Kavanaugh. You also wrote about Christine Blasey Ford, who had accused him of inappropriate behavior, and also Anita Hill.
Yeah, I mean, I wanted to have the center of the book be some reflections on Me Too, on the ways that it worked, on the ways that it didn't work, on the ways in which it is substituted for having meaningful investigations and due process. And so I really wanted to think about Christine Blasey Ford as an avatar for the proposition that people believed her. I was in the room when she testified. I don't think anyone in the room thought she was lying. But nevertheless, Judge Kavanaugh was elevated to the Supreme Court and went on this spring to be a vote to overturn Roe. And so I think we disserved both Dr. Ford, who took, I think, a huge risk, and I think we served Judge Kavanaugh by not having any meaningful investigation. And so what was the point of all of that other than, I think, to have this kind of public forum that was not a formal legal process, and then step over Dr. Ford and say, oh, well, bygones. And now we are, you know, locked into a Supreme Court probably for decades that will be disrespectful of women's rights.
We just have a minute, but you also profiled Stacey Abrams and Roberta Kaplan. Why?
Again, I wanted to have a Black woman, a white woman, somebody who is at a big law firm, somebody who is an organizer. I think I just want every young person in the country who's going to law school to see something of themselves in one or another of these heroes.
And Roberta Kaplan, people may not know, the attorney who took on the KKK, the far right in Charlottesville, where you lived for so many years. In fact, you were pivotal to her coming down here and suing them.
Robbie Kaplan is an example of somebody who filed a lawsuit in 2017 that didn't go to trial until 2021, but got a massive $26 million judgment against white supremacists and Nazis in Charlottesville. It's another, for me, story about how the law is slow and takes a long time, but at its best, it really can make us all freer and safer and restore dignity to those who've been harmed.
Dahlia Lithwick, we thank you so much for being with us, covering the courts and the law for Slate, hosting the podcast Amicus. Her new book is just out. It's called Lady Justice: Women, the Law, and the Battle to Save America. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is currently accepting applications for two full-time jobs.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. The time is 8 a.m. Next up is Wednesday Talk Radio with Paul Roland.
You're slick, you investors in hate, you Saddams and you Bushes, you Bin Ladens and snakes, you billionaire bullies, you're a globalized curse, you put war on the masses and then you clean out the purse, and that's how it's done, war after war, you old feudal parasites, you just sacrifice the poor. You got the cutting-edge weapons, but your scam's still the same as it's been since the Romans. Yo, it's the Patriot game. Yo, that's the war racket. It's the war racket. It's the war racket. It's the war racket. You twisters of language. You creeps of disguise. Yeah, disinformation. It's like worms in your eyes. You privileged bankers. You gambler thieves. You profit on war. You think it's just less money in peace. So that's how it's done. Time after time. Country after country. And crime after crime. You pretend it's religion. Like there's no one to blame. For the dead and impoverished. In your little Patriot game, money, that's the war racket. That's the war racket.
And good morning, everybody. This is Wednesday Talk Radio here on your community radio station, KBOO. I am your host every week here, Paul Rowland. I just want to apologize for last week. Those of you who are listening, that was a bit of a chaotic mess. Did not have a board operator. I had to do it all by myself. And I didn't figure out that you have to actually go to the back phone to reactivate the phone lines, which are always rerouted in order to get call-ins. So if anybody actually tried to call in and didn't get through, that's why. And anyway, things happen. So here we are with a new show, and we're going to be talking about Guam, the Philippines, and the accelerating militarization of the Pacific. And we're going to start off here in a second. I've got two live guests from the group Gabriela, which you'll hear all about, and I will introduce them after we play this segment. You may remember Julian Aguan, who's an indigenous human rights lawyer and writer from Guam on Democracy Now!, I think like a week and a half ago or so. Anyway, he'll be in Portland coming up this coming Monday, October 3 at 7 o'clock at the Powell's downtown on Burnside, talking about his life, work, and struggle by way of his new book, No Country for Eight Spot Butterflies. And so we're going to hear that segment, and people can decide if they want to actually go hear him live and perhaps pick up a copy of his book on Monday. So, Ty, if you'd like to play that segment.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. As tension rises between the United States and China, we look at how U.S. militarism in Guam, the westernmost territory of the United States during World War II, Guam was a key naval and air force base for the United States in the Pacific. The U.S. now expanding its military operations in Guam. The Pentagon's 2023 budget calls for nearly $900 million to build a new missile defense system on Guam. The U.S. is also moving ahead with plans to relocate 5,000 Marines to Guam and build a new machine gun range near a wildlife refuge. We're joined now by Julian Aguan, a leading Chamorro writer and human rights lawyer from Guam. He is the founder of the law firm Blue Ocean Law, and a 2022 Pulitzer Prize finalist for commentary, author of several books, including his latest, released today. He has now just arrived in New York, No Country for the Eight Spot Butterflies. Welcome back to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us, Julian. We've been talking about the British Empire a lot with the death of the Queen, but you write about the American Empire. It has more than 800 military bases around the world. Guam is a major site. Talk about Guam's significance, your homeland.
Sure. Guam is the ancestor homeland of my people, the indigenous Chamorro people, who have been there and have called that land home for over 3,500 years. We are a matrilineal society. We have a set of sort of values that are our constitutive values, chief among them reciprocity. We are directly in the line of fire. We are definitely a frontline community when it comes to the spreading canopy of U.S. militarization. As I speak, my people are bracing ourselves for a round of militarization that is nothing less than cataclysmic. And I say that in an intentionally existential way. As you know, Guam is in the crosshairs. Sort of whenever the war games are afoot between the U.S., the U.S. is greatly expanding its military footprint. This springs from a 2005 agreement with the U.S., between the U.S. government and the government of Japan, to transfer thousands of U.S. Marines from Okinawa, which shoulders a disproportionate amount of U.S. military presence in its own right. And those Marines are now coming to Guam. And as part of that Marine relocation, the U.S. military military is currently expanding its footprint in Guam. It is expanding its base. It has created a brand new Marine Corps base, and it is also constructing a live fire training range complex. And that complex consists of five different ranges, live fire training ranges, the largest and most important of which is a 59-acre multi-purpose machine gun range. And that is the range that I talk about in this book, because it directly imperils a host of our other than human relatives, including our endemic eight spot butterfly.
And Julian, in terms of this military expansion, clearly, obviously geared to the rising tensions between China and the United States, all of this is being done when it comes to Guam without any involvement of the people of Guam themselves. Your country remains one of only 17 territories that are still considered colonies by the United Nations. Even the level of self-government, let's say, at some of the other former colonies of the U.S. or the colonies of the U.S., Puerto Rico, the Federation of Micronesia have received, Guam still remains in a category by itself. I'm wondering if you could talk about how the people feel of what is going on, how the United States treats Guam.
Thank you so much for that question, Juan. I think that it's critical to sort of face that question head on. Guam is a U.S.-administered non-self-governing territory whose decolonization process has been thwarted by the U.S. government for 123 years and counting. Guam has had a long history of fighting for the fundamental right of self-determination. I myself was involved in a decades-long battle throughout the federal court system to try to defend the right of the native inhabitants of Guam to express our desires with regard to our future political status, our future political relationship with the U.S. government, which has failed. And it's sort of like right now what we see happening is the harms of 500 years of colonization sort of being exacerbated by a hyper-aggressive, unilateral sort of expansion of the U.S. military. So this is really, Guam is where sort of like the legacy of colonial violence is now sort of being compounded upon by the sort of the harms of the U.S. government. And I mean that in every sense. For example, in August 2017, North Korea was threatening Guam with weapons, intercontinental ballistic weapons that was said to be reach Guam in 14 minutes. In August 2020, China launched 4 missiles into the South China Sea, one of which, it's the DF-26, it nicknamed Guam Killer. The U.S. government right now claims that it's sort of expanding its military footprint in order to sort of bolster up the defense of the nation, but we know better. With the war games already afoot out at sea, the operation, several different variations of war games are afoot, including Operation Valiant Shield, which is not unlike RIMPAC, which just concluded in Hawaii. And all of these war games, the sort of increased escalation. I mean, we see this at the congressional level with regard to rhetoric about China emerging as the U.S.'s biggest pacing challenge. And we see this on the ground. And what this means on the ground to the people is, loss of land, loss of our preciously singular sort of habitat. For example, the firing range being built now in Guam, it entails the destruction of over 1,000 acres of pristine limestone forests. These forests took millennia to evolve and are impossibly beautiful. And they are directly sort of, they're on the chopping block, many of those acres have already been cleared. Certain portions of the Ratidian area, which is an area that is sacred to my people, have been already bulldozed. And so I write about that in the book. I write about how it's bitterly ironic that so many of these sort of machines that are ripping the sort of limestone from the forest floor. These machines bear the name Caterpillar. Yet it's that sort of creature's preciously singular habitat, these limestone forests, that are being bulldozed. And I sort of land on this insight in the book. I finally get to this and I realize that this is sort of what's happening. The U.S. is a country that prefers routinely power over strength and living over letting live. And that a country like that, perhaps, is no country for eight spot butterflies.
I was wondering, Julian, if you could read a poem from your book.
Sure. I can read a poem that I wrote on climate change. And I wrote this poem shortly after one of the COPs. Let me just find it. Sorry.
And as you talk, I should say people should tune into our coverage of the UN COP, the UN Climate Summit that will be taking place in November in Sharm el-Sheikh in Egypt. Julian, go ahead.
Thank you. We have no need for scientists to tell us things we already know, like the sea is rising and the water is getting warm. The inundated need no instruction in inundation. We have eyes of our own, and besides, we are busy scraping barnacles off our grandfathers' graves and other headstones drowned at high tide. We know how critical it is our coral reefs stay healthy and our mangrove forests dense. We will defend them to the end, not because some study shows they provide protection from erosion or shelter from storms, but because our reefs are adoring aunts feeding other people's children, and our mangroves, mothers in their own right.
As you come to the mainland United States, your final message, Julian, as your book comes out today, No Country for Eight Spot Butterflies.
I think that we have to be really honest about sort of the U.S. war machine, and that and just like climate change, stop using sort of future tense. The crisis is here. You know, it's not only at our doorstep, but it's banging down the door. You know, and it is time to end these endless wars, and we should begin in Guam.
Julian Agin, I want to thank you for being with us.
And again, that was Julian Agin from Guam speaking on Democracy Now! Last week. And he will be again here this coming Monday, October 3 at 7 p.m. at the Powell's downtown on Burnside. He'll actually be in conversation with Karen Russell, talking about this book and his life and work and struggle and reflections on all that is going on and being in such an amazing strategic place so heavily impacted by American projection of power, which also the Philippines, along with Guam, has been forced to play a pivotal role in the projection of United States economic and military power into the Pacific and around the world. Guam is still a colonized territory of the United States, and the Philippines was in the past and continues to be in a strategic position in the geological strategies and objectives of the U.S. and China. And to talk about the Philippines, I have two guests this morning. Angelica Lim is a member of Gabriela Portland and the International Relations Officer of Gabriela USA. Lani Paguayo is a queer non-binary youth organizer and is the vice chair of Anak Bayan East Portland. They are both members of Bayan Portland, an overseas progressive alliance of Filipinos for national democracy with a socialist perspective. Reach out to Bayan Portland at bayanusa.pdx@gmail.com. Okay, and they'll be talking about what's been going on, including the 50th anniversary of the dictatorship of Ferdinand Marcos. So good morning, first Angelica.
Good morning, Paul. Thanks for having us.
You're quite welcome. And Lani, good morning.
Good morning. Happy to be here.
Great. And we're so, it's so nice to have you here. It was a little bit last minute flurry of activity getting you on, but it all worked out. And it's a really timely time again with Julian Agin coming to Portland. And maybe some of these kind of cross connections could be furthered. But first of all, He was talking about the American Empire. I don't know, give us a brief sort of a historical overview of the Philippines' role in the American Empire? That's a big first question, I know.
Oh, history lesson. Can you hear me okay?
Uh-huh.
Good. Yeah, thanks again, Paul. I think it is not just timely, it's a past time. I think to what Julian had mentioned on Democracy Now, we're looking at the heightened aspects of U.S. empire really trying to consolidate throughout the world. And I think it makes sense that we're all here today. I mean, just a little bit about the Philippines and its kind of relationship, if you will, with the U.S. The U.S. has been, the U.S. invaded the Philippines and colonized the Philippines in 1898. And for 50 years, U.S. colonization, post-Spanish colonization, was, was what was happening in the Philippines. We're talking about a colonization of, I think Julian mentioned it, hearts and minds, a colonization of education, of extracting resources. And then, there was a little period of time where the U.S. Was kicked out of the Philippines and then came back, but not in the formal colonial way. When we talk about the Philippines, we actually see the Philippines as a semi-colonial, has semi-colonial character, both semi-colonial and semi-feudal. The semi-colonial aspect is that in paper, the U.S. has granted the Philippines freedom. But I think I was talking to someone recently, when the U.S. grants freedom, that is not, freedom is not given. Freedom is fought for. And so now, the U.S. Influences the Philippines through economic policy, through U.S. intervention, through militarism, through cultural imperialism. And they really set their claws, U.S. colonization set their claws in the Philippines, particularly with language, with the way in which people understand their commitment to the Philippine nation. I'm forgetting the, I think it was not McCarthy, MacArthur might have called the Philippines little brown Americans back in the day. So there's already a lot of colonial mindset, and now it's translated to empire. I don't know, Lani, if there's anything else you want to add.
Yeah, like our little brown brothers and sisters. Oof, so disgusting. I think America has not left, and America will not leave unless Filipinos fight back alongside our siblings and alongside our frontline communities in the Pacific.
So I neglected actually to have you yourselves talk about some of the organizations you're involved with and their presence in Portland, which is quite strong. So maybe start with Gabriela Portland. What's that all about?
Oh, yeah. So Gabriela Portland is part of the overall overseas chapter of Gabriela USA. We are an extension of Gabriela in the Philippines, which is, it's essentially a grassroots-based alliance of 200 organizations in the Philippines, but there's a lot more across the world too. Really just fighting for Filipino women's rights, organizing Filipino women in the Philippines, but also across the world. We take up issues around, particularly day-to-day issues in the Philippines, answering, like, meeting specific needs, economic needs of Filipino women. But we also take up campaigns around domestic violence, against domestic violence, against sexual assault, against militarism. It's a class-based organization. And so here in the diaspora, here in the U.S., we also take up our role as Filipino women and also encourage our allies to come through to play a part in the liberation of Filipino women in the overall national democratic movement in the Philippines. So we're like the women's sector of national democracy in the Philippines.
So Lani, maybe you could talk about Anak Bayan East Portland and the Bayan Portland group generally.
Yeah, sure. So I am the vice chair of Anak Bayan East Portland. We represent the youth sector of the National Democratic Movement. So what does that really mean, being here, living here overseas in Portland, Oregon? We focus more on the particular youth issues that affect Filipinos. So education, debt, culturally relevant education, defending and promoting indigenous sovereignty and indigenous schools for our indigenous communities back in the Philippines. And so being part of the youth sector, we are part of the National Democratic Movement overall alongside Gabriela Portland. And then we also have another worker-specific organization called Migrante, which represents the migrant-specific issues.
And I want to get back into the sort of broader issues of militarization of the Pacific, U.S.-China relations. But before we do that, I want to let people know you are listening to Wednesday Talk Radio. I'm the regular weekly host, Paul Roland, and I have two guests with me, Angelica Lim and Lani Paguayo. And they are both organizers here in Portland with Philippine Solidarity and Philippine-based organizations with their Portland chapters. And we were talking about many things relating to the Philippines, but specifically, I know last week, I did want to mention quickly, this is a call-in show, and you are encouraged and welcome to call in and make your questions or comments to our guests. And the number is 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. But so last week, we haven't even really talked about the United States' role in propping up the presidency, which became a dictatorship, of Ferdinand Marcos, starting in the 60s. And then it's the 50th anniversary last week of his declaration of martial law. And I know there were a lot of events, and especially it's all coming back around because his son, Ferdinand Jr., or Bongbong Marcos, was just recently elected president. How about that? So talk about how, talk about maybe some of your reflections on that history of the Marcos family, and then some of the, what you're doing in relation to the election of Bongbong, and then some of the events that happened around the commemoration of the dictatorship 50 years ago.
It is not a surprise that Marcos Jr. is back in the highest position of the land. His family has had a 36-year-long disinformation campaign to persuade the Filipino people and our international community of calling martial law the golden age of the Philippines, or the golden era of the Philippines. We know that is not true. We know that martial law has ravaged our people, has tortured, harassed, arrested, killed thousands of our people, and that is a history that we cannot forget, even as Filipinos living overseas. We actually find and come across Filipino migrants who think that martial law was good, who think that martial law disciplined our children, disciplined the country, helped promote nationalism and patriotic aspects in our people. That's not true. It was all Marcos Sr. trying to take control and power over the Philippines while plunging the Philippines further into debt. We see that Marcos Sr. has welcomed the World Bank, the IMF, into unimaginable debt that the Filipino people still have to pay off today. And that even Filipino migrants here, right in our backyard, right in Oregon, are sending remittances that are paying for this debt of the Marcos family. All while Marcos Jr. was invited to the New York United Nations General Assembly when there is a contempt order against him and his family. If you ask Marcos Jr. to this day if about his family's embezzlement of $10 billion, not pesos, $10 billion, he will flat out deny it. That is not okay. Whether you're Filipino or not Filipino, this dynasty stole from our people, from the workers of the world.
And there was a judgment actually against him in the United States court, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Correct. Yeah. $353 million contempt order that he has been excused from because currently he is the the leader of the Philippines. So already you're seeing the collusion of the U.S. and the Philippines. I think to quickly also add to what Lonnie was offering, I think the election of Marcos Jr. or Bongbong, if he's so he's noted, he's called, has been pretty fraught, right? We see a very intense campaign around disinformation to erase the history that the U.S. had a particular role in, right? The repression of activists under martial law, the torture and disappearances of activists, but also just, you know, very much like the Marcos legacy or dynasty really is about revising history, but also revising to repeat history. And one could argue that Marcos Jr. is actually on, like, the way he is going about his leadership and is really his father's legacy on steroids. When last week we had the opportunity to be represented in New York through Gabriela Portland and Bayan Portland, and we were able to see firsthand that Marcos Jr., if we want to talk about how the U.S., how the U.S. colludes with the Philippines, or is more like a puppet government of the Philippines. Actually, the other way around. They are the puppet master of the puppet government of the Philippines. His time here was really about auctioning off the Philippines. And we know that, and auctioning off the Philippines, changing the economic conditions in the Philippines by really letting in foreign investment. And I think that's how we connected to militarism, because when we start to see foreign investment, we're going to see how militarism, U.S. militarism, protects not the people, but actually,
Right. He says foreign investment, we see foreign intervention yes. on the ground.
Yes.
Well, so the United States definitely had a huge role in propping up the first Marcos regime. Mm-hmm. Starting in the 60s. And of course, the Philippines played an absolutely crucial, central role in basically being the staging area for the Vietnam War, which maybe a lot of people aren't aware, but they, you know, the Subic Naval Base and the Clark Air Force Base were busy probably 24/7, just about, certainly at times, in, you know, being the staging area for military operations in the Philippines. It was like the two huge bases. And I know there's a whole process of renegotiating those bases and the relationship, and I don't believe either of them are still there. You can correct me if I'm wrong. I'm sure that there is, you talked about the U.S. collusion in torture and disappearance and such. I'm sure that there is, similar to in what happened in Central America, there is no doubt military advisors that were right there with Marcos, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And I mean, under Marcos and other regimes in the Philippines, too. But one thing that we can really make a direct connection to is the way that the Philippine government, particularly, you know, under Marcos, under martial law, under fascism, takes a page out of the book of the United States. The same activity around COINTELPRO that happened here in this country is very much reenacted in the Philippines. The same red tagging, terror tagging, disinformation, you know, all of that is very much, it's duplicated in the Philippines. And so we saw that under the Marcos senior area. We've seen it since then. We saw it very heavily under the Duterte administration, Duterte regime. He created a national task force to end local communist armed conflict. What does that even mean? And he ended up just terror tagging anybody who had anything, or red tagging any activist who had anything to say against the government.
Right.
Almost to the point of, there were extrajudicial killings that had, this was all under Duterte. And then we have now Marcos Jr., who has verbally committed to extending this type of reinforcement in the Philippines. And all of this is backed by U.S. aid, you know, backed in military budget. Yes.
So, so let's talk about, I know that there's, let's talk about what your groups are actually doing. I know that there's a bill that's been proposed and languished, and maybe just sort of talk about what the funding is like now. Is there now talk of increased military funding? What's sort of going on, and how are your organizations fighting back against that? Maybe Lonnie?
Yeah. So the bill that you mentioned is the FRA, the Philippine Human Rights Act, and that bill we've been pushing since 2019 to suspend all military aid to the Philippine National Police, to the Armed Forces of the Philippines, until there is an independent investigation of Duterte's war crimes, essentially. I believe that Representative Susan Wild has endorsed this, has really championed it. And here locally, we really need Senator Merkley to champion this, to introduce this into the Senate. You know, for someone who talks about democracy and human rights, and now with the new Marcos Jr. administration, we shouldn't even be giving Marcos Jr. a chance. This is not okay. We've seen continued arrests and harassment and disappearances of activists within the first 100 days of his administration. We cannot neglect that. It is clear that, I mean, this is still within the first 100 days, but we still need to keep Duterte accountable for his crimes against humanity, for being a war criminal. And this bill, the Philippine Human Rights Act, is still relevant in accomplishing that.
Mm-hmm. So currently, since 2015, there has been $1 billion U.S. dollars, U.S. tax dollars invested in U.S. Aid to the Philippines. So that is just something that, you know, for listeners who are like, where's the Philippines? What is the Philippines? How does this relate to me? That's just something that impacts anyone here in the United States. There is a role. To what Lonnie is saying, yeah, this is the PHRA, the Philippine Human Rights Act, is one way that we see our organizations participating to really press on the leaders of this country who say they are about human rights, who are against human rights violations, who are against fascism and state repression. And so it really is an invitation for our leaders. That is one way we're doing things. A lot of the other things that we're doing are just to really organize in our community, organize the people who are impacted by having to leave the Philippines and migrate to the United States, and understanding their conditions and how both the Philippine and the U.S. government can support them. Other ways we do that is just taking up issues to expose what is happening in the Philippines through political education and really... we're just an extension of the mass movement in the Philippines to really ensure that people in the United States know of the role of the U.S. and how we can organize against the U.S., the belly that we live in, and then really towards a national and free, liberated, a sovereign Philippines.
Right. I would even add that last week, to commemorate the 50th anniversary of martial law, we held a teach-in for Filipino youth. On the day that Vice President Sara Duterte was supposed to come to the Transforming Education Summit in New York, but Anak Bayan East Portland, along with Anak Bayan USA, we sent over 3,000 letters to the UN to revoke her invitation. And, you know, we don't know the clear reason of why she decided not to go, but we still consider this a people's victory, a hard-earned victory to ensure that we don't have Duterte, any of the Dutertes, or any fascist in you know, as an education leader. So we did that, and then we also held a vigil locally, where Portland residents actually shared stories of martial law, and it was really interesting to hear how something that happened almost 50 years ago still impacts people. Like, people grew up during war, people grew up in the crosshairs of firefights. a Filipina tita actually shared how police would go around and cut off the skirts of young girls just to harass them in the streets. And then on the actual day of September 21st, on the 50th anniversary, we held a screening of Liwai, a martial law film in our community, all within 24 hours of another screening in the Philippines, where the Philippine National Police actually shut down that screening. So, especially as Bayan Portland, we say we agitate, organize, and mobilize, we AOM, but we have the privilege of doing propaganda, of doing the counter-propaganda work to Marcos's revising of history, because while they're shutting down film screenings about martial law, we can be here on KBOO talking about the real history of the people.
Right on, and we're so glad you are, and I do want to reintroduce you. This is Wednesday Talk Radio. I'm the host, Paul Rowland, and my guest today... Oh, I just took you off.
Angelica, Lim.
And Lonnie.
Hello.
And I was looking at another program page, which I wanted from a previous show, which I want to talk about in a second. But, you know, you mentioned that word fascist a couple times, and I don't know, it's just on my mind. My dad actually grew up in Italy under the Mussolini, and never did talk about it much. But I know he was actually in the resistance as a very young man, and it's a story to tell. Unfortunately, I never got it from him. Unfortunately, that's such a common thing. Mm-hmm. But yeah, the fascists are now back in power in Italy, just as Marcos is back in power in the Philippines. It's we seem to be going backwards in a lot of places, forward here and there. But so this is a call-in program. I've mentioned the number once. I'll mention it again. We only have less than 20 minutes left. So if you did want to get your question or comment in, I'd encourage you to do it relatively soon. 503-231-8187. So I did want to – I had on Zoltan Grossman from Evergreen State College, who talked about about militarization in the Pacific Northwest, specifically the Puget Sound, which is something I've started to learn about recently. But the projection of U.S. power into the Pacific, the Puget Sound played an extremely crucial role, including the very beginning with the invasion of the Philippines. So this is we talk about think globally, act locally. You know, you were mentioning that maybe people have a hard time sort of, you know, focusing in on the Philippines. But if people really do want to take seriously the challenges that we're in today, which I admit is hard, it's a big sordid mess. But I've been focusing on the crucial necessity of demilitarization. If we have any chance of actually addressing climate change in a serious way, the military having such an outsized role in both creating the problem and preventing its solution. And since the U.S. and China are the two major emitters of greenhouse gases, it would behoove them to actually get together, but they seem to be going in the opposite direction.
Absolutely.
So there's two directions I want to go in. Maybe we can start with that. I did want to pick up on the thread about the organizing in the Philippine community. Maybe we could sort of end with that. But yeah, this whole the Philippines is Julian Aguon was talking about the Guam's the missiles being lobbed towards Guam, and one being called a Guam killer from China, and then, you know, North Korea. But the Philippines is right there between China and Guam, and it's also between the United States and Guam. So you're really in it. So this is if we have ambitions to really change the nature of the reality we're in, it seems like you all are in a really important role, and the Philippines and Guam are crucial places.
Yeah, I'm curious to see. You know, we still are within the first 100 days of Bongbong's administration, but where is he leaning towards in terms of U.S. and China? And how is that going to affect the Filipino people? How is that going to affect Filipino migrants? You know, while he was in New York at the U.N. General Assembly, he went to an Eric Clapton show. He went to a Broadway show. He was spending up to $1,400 a night gallivanting, having fun, while the Filipino people are in crisis. Within the last month, the peso, the Philippine peso, has plunged 6 times. I think today we are at 59 pesos to one U.S. dollar. What is that? Mm-hmm. So in thinking about is Marcos, you know, Marcos is flirting, is courting with U.S. imperialism and China encroaching on Philippine sovereignty. We also have to acknowledge that the West Philippine Sea has been a hot issue under the Duterte administration. There was an incident, I believe, back in 2020 where Philippine fishermen were rammed by a Chinese military vessel. And if it weren't for Vietnamese fishermen nearby to save them, they would have been stranded. And I believe they were stranded for days without any help. So in thinking about, you know, when we say National Democratic, when we say we're part of the National Democratic Movement, it's really protecting our rights as a people, protecting our rights over our land and our sea, which was, you know, it's the West Philippine Sea. It was ruled in our name, in our country's name.
Mm-hmm. As opposed to what the Chinese call it, of course, which is the South China Sea. And right. I like it that you pointedly call it that.
The West Philippine Sea. I think, in addition to that, so we've got like a historical base to understand how this pivot to the Asia, you know, the Asia Pacific has been really strategic, right, in the continuing heightened tension of imperialist powers in the globe, so China and the U.S. The Philippines' strategic role in that is that sometimes we've been called a locker to hold to hold ammo, to hold guns, to hold military equipment, even though, and we still have lots of U.S. bases in the Philippines, but there is no war in the Philippines. There are policies called, you know, the Visiting Forces Agreement, and then also EDCA, the Enhanced Defense Cooperation Agreement. Both of these policies under the name of security. But who's security? I think that's something that we have to, we have to actually examine as people in this country. When Marcos was at in the U.S. just recently, to Lonnie's point, his priority is for foreign investment. But we know that foreign investment in the Philippines is always coupled with U.S. intervention and U.S. military intervention to protect the greedy ambitions of the 1% and the consolidation of power across the world. What Marcos really talks about or frames it as is security. Marcos said, we know that we can count on the United States to uphold the international law-based order, freedom of navigation and overflight, and the sustainable use and development of maritime resources. He also said that equally important, we look to the United States to promote peace, security, and prosperity. On our part, we will continue to work with China and other claimant states with the end viewing of resolving issues involving the West Philippine Sea. His diplomacy is weird. His message is clear. If the Philippines looks to the United States for sovereignty, security, prosperity, there's something very wrong, because on this show today, we're talking about U.S. intervention and how much U.S. militarism is impacting the world, is impacting the globe. Environmentally speaking, it is the number one polluter. And so at what cost is the question we have to ask. And then also, you know, at the end of the day, Marcos Jr. is showing himself as a nice little lapdog for the Philippines as the U.S. continues to intervene.
So I just want to, you know, the tensions around Taiwan, just occurred to me. I mean, if the United States and China really go to war, boy, it's going to be a mess in the Philippines.
Yeah. That, I mean, I think that that's another thing that we have to really think about, the people. We don't actually think about the people. The way that U.S. military, U.S. aid really shows itself in the Philippines has been disastrous. So historically, when we have military policies like the Visiting Forces Agreement or EDCA, who does that impact the most? Filipino people, but Filipino women. The rates of rape and sexual assault with U.S. Military men in the Philippines is high. The rates of prostitution is very high. And that is that's a trend of U.S. imperialism really finding ways to exist, right? And then we're talking about if there is a war, Who suffers the most? That is the land and resources of the Filipino people. They become the people in the limbo between a war that they did not start and they have nothing to do with except to exploit.
Right. We are coming up on the eighth anniversary of the death and murder of Jennifer Laude, a trans woman who was a prostitute in one of the red districts in the Philippines, in the red light districts in the Philippines. She was also an activist, and she was murdered by U.S. Marine Joseph Scott Pemberton. And under the Duterte administration, he was pardoned. The Marine was pardoned in exchange for COVID vaccines. Like, that is not okay. In the end, I think Joseph Scott Pemberton walked free. He was able to return safely to Hawaii, where some of our buy-in organizations protested him. But I think for me as a queer non-binary youth organizer, like, we have to think about how is this going to affect our youth? How is this going to affect trans people?
So I did want to, so what are the American military actually doing there is, I guess, a question. I sort of glided over that by talking about the fact that Subic and Clark are not operational anymore. Is that's true or not?
Clark is, I was just there in 2019. They have military presence there. A lot, actually, when Biden became president, he enacted the training of military forces of the Armed Forces of the Philippines and the Philippine National Police. So
that's basically for suppression of insurrections.
Absolutely. Yeah. So that's the thing. I think that's the answer to your question. Why are they there?
Right.
I mean, Marcos and maybe not Duterte, but other presidents before would say it's because of security, because it is very easy for a puppet government to say, hey, we're scared and we need all the foreign support we can get. But in actuality, what would it look like if the Filipino people rose up and actually exposed that the interest of the Philippine government and U.S. government are not of the best interest of the people? You need military forces, which is an aspect of fascism.
And of course, it used to be under the rubric of the global fight against communism, which was, of course, the stupid, misguided reason for the Vietnam War and all the disaster and tragedy and pain that it took. But now it's all under the rubric of the War on Terror, which Duterte certainly utilized. But we only have a few minutes left. We don't have any callers. I don't know why. I guess they're just so entranced by our conversation, which is great. No, I think...
Thanks.
But I did want to pivot. You can talk about what I just said, but maybe Lonnie. The whole issue of the Philippine community, I mean, obviously it has so much, the fact that there's so many Filipinos on the West Coast obviously has to do with our being on the Pacific and more proximity, but there's, all over the country, and there's a large Philippine diaspora all over the world, which has to do with the economic issues to
the
use
US
a bland
economic,
word,
yeah.
U.S. economic colonization, et cetera, mm-hmm. and the neoliberal policies and all that. But so I've always been struck by the activism of the Philippine community here in Portland, how vibrant it is. There's, you all have so much presence in a lot of different, spaces around town in terms of protests and such, and you have a lot of different organizations. But organizing with the in the community, because I mean, really, the people there, a majority of people did vote for Duterte and now voted for Marcos Jr. Mm-hmm. So you're you're in terms of strident activist movements, you're in a minority both in the Philippines, but here I kind of wonder how it is. What is the community, and is it difficult? Are there are there like open fights between people?
Wow, that is a great question. I think we're living in Portland, living in the Northwest. We're in a unique position where there are not open fights. There are not huge, big BBM supporters, or what we call DDS, diehard Duterte supporters. And they're not in actual, or as far as I know, they're not in actual big groups where they're actually rallying. But I think we do have to conduct what we call our United Front work. Have meetings with them, conduct town halls with them, conduct storytelling sessions to get a sense of like where they're at and how they want to see the Philippines be free at the end of the day. Because yeah, we'll come across Marcos supporters who are working class migrants, but we have to understand they're victims of disinformation, and we have to do our role as organizers to be patient with them, to listen to their stories, and listen to their issues at the end of the day. If they're concerned about sending remittances home, let's talk about the, Marcos Jr.'s, what he calls his unity budget, and understand where that's really going. Is that really going to food security and healthcare and education, or is it going to his ballooning military budget?
I think to add to what Lonnie is offering too, is that we are all a product of our society, and so I think a lot of our society, and I think an activist and organizer or human rights defender's role is to change society for the better. And so when we might be the minority, but maybe our politics and the front seem like a minority, but actually our biggest unity with our people is that we love our people. We love our people so very much, and we understand that there have been economic policies in the Philippines that have forced people to migrate, and that is not the framing that they're using migration. It's just a fact of life. The Philippines is poor. It's hard to live there. And so what needs to happen is people move. That is very much persuaded by U.S. imperialism and bureaucrat capitalism and the lack of land resources, so, under the feudal nature in the Philippines. But I guess the essence of that is that our biggest goal is to be with our people and find out what issues in particular they are impacted by, so we can actually build.
Well, we do have our first and maybe probably only phone caller, since they're at the very... I really encourage people not to call with 5 minutes left. But since they did take the trouble, maybe you could make it really quick, because we do kind of need to wrap up. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Okay. If President Marcos back in the 60s, 70s was so terrible, how could his son be president? Everybody has really a bad, memory of it.
Okay, we'll let that go. Stand as your question. Go ahead.
So he was not elected president. This election was not fair. It was not clean. There was voter harassment, voter intimidation. He bought several of his votes. He paid by head, by person, people to attend his rallies to make it seem like there were more Marcos supporters than ever. Even President Biden, before the official election results came out, President Biden congratulated Marcos Jr. on a win. What is that? Marcos claimed that there were 31 million voters and votes for him, but those votes were bought. If we're talking about the Filipino people being poor, their means of economic livelihood is taking that money and trading it in for a vote.
I think the question is like, how could Trump get elected? think we actually have, like, to the question, thank you for calling. I think it is not so far to think that if Marcos comes from a family of money, that the disinformation that is spread, so like what we've been talking about on this show, is that he's done a lot, like the campaign to erase his father's nasty legacy is hardcore. And so, people remember what they remember, and also people need to survive. So it makes sense. yes, we see that the election was illegitimate. Also, at the end of the day, a lot of people, you hear a soundbite from a president's campaign, all of a sudden you're like, I want to be about that. But we know that actually, in actualization, his policies will not be for the people. So now it's just time just to expose it for what it is.
Well, with that, I think we're going to have to wrap it up really right about now. So I really appreciate you all coming in. Angelica Lim from Gabriela Portland and Lani Paguayo, a queer non-binary youth organizer with Anak Bayan East Portland, a part of the Bayan Portland organization. If people want to know more, you can go to my program page at kboo.fm. Thank you so much, both of you.
Thank you so much, Paul.
Thank you.
That'll wrap it up.
Oh, you're slick. You investors in hate. You Saddams and you Bushes. You Bin Ladens and snakes. You billionaire bullies. You a globalized curse. You put war on the masses and then you clean out the purse. And that's how it's done. War after war. You old feudal parasites. You just sacrifice the poor. You got the cutting edge weapons, but your scam's still the same as it's been since the Romans. Yo, it's the Patriot game. Yo, that's the war racket. It's the war racket. It's the war racket. It's the war racket. You twisters of language, you creeps of disguise. Yeah, disinformation. It's like worms in your eyes. You privileged bankers. You gambler thieves. You profit on war. You think it's just less money in peace. So that's how it's done. Time after time. Country after country. And crime after crime. You pretend it's religion. Like there's no one to blame. For the dead and impoverished.